Hello, I'm Daniel Browning. Welcome to Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on RN. Today on the show, Michael O'Loughlin is our guest. The Sydney Swans' one-time leading goal kicker has had time to reflect on his life in his autobiography.
And footy's given me a great life. It's given me a bloody good life. I've been able to look after my family and community because it's, you know, I can afford to be able to do that. And, you know, growing up, we had no such luxuries, I guess.
Also, we meet the rising new artist, Dale Harding, who's subverted the gentle domestic art of cross-stitching.
Yeah, the cross-stitch and the embroidery has been integral in my entire growing up and my sister. The boys maybe, the older boys didn't maybe get it so much, but yeah, it comes from mum, yeah. But also that practical skill as well. We need to know how to mend our pants, and we need to know how to put a button back on and these sorts of things. So the little grandsons now, as little boys, they're proficient in needlework as well. So it's something that mum makes sure that is part of all our lives, yeah.
And Amberlynn Quay-Mulliner on writing young adult fiction set in a dystopian future. Stay with me, that's all coming up here on Away. You can bet that former Sydney Swans forward and the club's one-time leading goal kicker, Michael O'Loughlin, was right behind his old team this afternoon as they lined up against Hawthorn in the AFL Grand Final. Mickey O, as he's called, retired 3 years ago at the end of the 2009 season. Throughout his 303-game career, his sense of loyalty to the club and his teammates was such that he never left the side. In his new autobiography written with Jim Mayne, Michael O'Loughlin's taken a stroll down memory lane. Up there in Darwin, Mickey O sat down with Away's Rico Adrin.
Firstly, Michael, as arduous as pre-season training may have been, or even playing at the elite level of your chosen sport, how difficult is it compared to publishing one's memoirs?
It's a long process, obviously, putting the book together, and something that I wouldn't do again. It's just such a, you know, it's time consuming. There's a lot of things that you've got to get right. But give me a football pre-season any day, I think. But look, yeah, we're absolutely wrapped with the end result, and we're so happy with the way it's turned out. And you know, I'm enjoying touring around Australia and sort of promoting it and talking about it a little bit, but. As I said, give me an AFL pre-season, and I'm more comfortable in that environment.
Why was it the right time to document your story so far?
I think it was... That's a good question. And you know what? It was, I actually rejected the first offer, and I spoke to my mum. She's in education, and she just thought it would be a great idea to have, you know, a black face on the shelves. And it's not just for Indigenous people. It's obviously a lot of our Swans fans, a lot of AFL fans have picked the book up. But I was lucky enough to do this show, Who Do You Think You Are? And a lot of people wanted to find out a lot more about myself. And I don't know, it was the right time. As I said, it's done. I don't think I'll write another one, but it was something that hopefully my kids can look back on when they're a bit older and find out a little bit more about their father.
Tell us about the process of piecing it together and working with Jim Mayne.
Look, Jim's he was the only guy I thought of when I said... I agreed to do this book, and it was he's such a big advocate, I guess, for Sydney, and I've known him for a long time now, and he certainly knows his stuff. He's written a few books, and he was just an automatic choice, and I love what he's been able to sort of help me through that process, and he's been around the block, I guess, a few times, and his advice and the way we sort of directed the book was invaluable. And yeah, as I said, we're stoked with the outcome. The response from the public has been overwhelming. It really has been going from strength to strength. And as I said, I mean, our Swan fans were always going to buy the book, but it's not just for you know, the red and white army. It's for literally for anybody. And I don't know. It was just it was great to sort of get the story done and put it out on paper. And I guess the big one was obviously for my kids. And they can sort of, they see Dad on the front cover of a book and they pick it up, and if that helps them to read, and they read it all right at the moment. So it's just a, it was an interesting process. It's totally out of my comfort zone, and something I can look back and be really proud of.
Before we continue, can we briefly talk about Plugger? You touched on the year 1996 in the book, but the Plugger versus God match.
Yeah.
Tell us about that day.
Look, there was, just playing with Plugger, probably the greatest player I've ever seen play the footy in terms of being a match winner, because whenever he decided to turn the game, he just did it, and there was no one was really going to argue with him, and an imposing figure on the field and off the field, but an all-round great guy as well. He loves a laugh. The locker room stuff was, he was legendary at, in terms of playing practical jokes and things like that, but he played in some big games, and obviously that one against the Geelong and Gary Ablett senior, and you know, the one where he kicked the point against Essendon to actually get us in the grand final, stuff that sort of legends are written, and they're fairy tale games that he played in, and he just dominated. Kick, you know, I remember watching a game, he kicked 16 straight, and I mean, the rest of us didn't even need him to play, I reckon. He was just that good. But he's the guy for me that can turn games consistently whenever he chose to, and there'll never be a player like him, I think, and I was lucky enough to have the front row seat, mate.
Just one more question about another footballer. Tell us what you know about Stephen Kernaghan.
Oh, Sticks, an unbelievable player. I was a Carlton fan as a kid, so I naturally gravitated to all the South Australian players playing for Carlton at that stage. They'd won a final, grand final. Robert Walls was the coach, and it was, you know, I was a mad Carlton supporter. So, unfortunately, well, fortunately for me now, Sydney snapped me up first. At the time, I thought it was the worst thing that could possibly happen to me, and I was devastated because I always wanted to play for the Navy Blues. And and Sticks is, you know, he's a champion player. He's now obviously running the show at Carlton, but he was inspirational to be able to watch him play. And it was a little bit of, I mean, if these Adelaide boys can do it, then maybe I could. It's a bit like the Territory boys when they see another Territory player running around for an AFL club. But, you know, the dreams and the, you know, your mind takes over going, well, Jesus, if I work hard and I do this, this and this, maybe I could do that. And I was the same. So, and he was certainly one of the heroes of mine.
Could you outline what made you stand out as an up-and-coming footballer?
I think for me, I was always really driven as a young kid. The eldest of five kids. And it was just, certainly for me, I've been told a lot when I was a kid what I wasn't good at. So very rarely did someone give you a pat on the back and say, well, that was really good. And I think when I left to go to Sydney, a lot of people thought I'd be back with my tail between my legs within a year or two. So there was a bit of that. And it was, you know, I'm going to show these guys. And I sort of had that attitude, which is a good attitude to have because, you know, it was... I just happened to be lobbed up at the right club at the right time with the right people. And the Sydney Swans Footy Club looked after me big time, and I'm sure I probably caused them a few headaches. But the relationship that I have with them, and you know, I'm welcome there any time I want. And being the first player to play 300 for the club's been around for 130 odd years. So it's, you know, South Melbourne and the Sydney Swans. We've had the most Brownlow medalists play for our footy club. But we haven't had a lot of team success, and you know, when we win a grand final, the people there treat you really, really well. And but I guess I've always been that kid who I was always sort of good at sports, but I just didn't know how to, I guess, apply that consistently. And when I got to Sydney, I was able to do that because I listened, learned. I was really humble, really respectful of the people around there, and I just watched, I listened, and I learned. And I made the decision that I'll never go back to Adelaide. And, you know, that's always been in the back of the mind, and I was able to do that and make a really successful career in Sydney.
Exactly how much do you miss chucking the boots on and having a run?
I don't miss the playing side of things that much. I miss the locker room stuff. That's where you form your friendships and your mates, and, you know, you're having a laugh with the guys in the locker room. That's the I can't explain it for people who have never been in a locker room and all you do is you're hanging a lot of grief on your teammates, and you're paying them out, and you're making fun, and you're playing practical jokes, you're finding out about people, 40 other people in the locker room. It's a unique place. There's no other place like it in the world. And to be a professional sportsman and enjoy that environment for 16 years every day, and that's every day, you find out about people and you learn a lot about people, and that's the stuff that I really miss.
For you, Michael, what is it about competitive sport that led you to forge a path and make a career out of it?
I don't know. I really loved playing, three games on a weekend when I was a kid. And you'd play in your grade, and then you'd play in the, you'd fill in for the older grade, and then you'd fill in for another. Like, it was just, I don't know, I was a bit of a glutton for punishment, I guess. I love getting knocked over and tackled, and if I beat someone older than me, I was really happy with myself. And I guess that really started at that young age. And, football came really sort of natural. I was always good at the ball sports, cricket, basketball. But I always wanted to be the best as well. And I guess that really that was instilled in me early, because, as I said, I played a lot of outside my depth. I trained with a lot of the older players, and I got beaten up a fair bit on the footy field. And that certainly made me the person I am today. If you tell me I can't do it, well, I'd be one of those guys to go out and prove it, that I could do it. And that would be in anything. If you said I couldn't cook you a good steak, well, I'd prove you wrong. I would learn, and then I would learn, then I would learn, and then until I could do it properly. If you said I made the lawns terribly, well, I'd make sure I learned how to do the lawns properly. So I guess that was a really good side of me, and footy is the same thing. I had talent, but talent takes you so far, and you have to work your backside off to be a really successful player.
If you look back, when do you feel you peaked? When was it when everything you touched was gold?
I think certainly when Paul came, and I learned how to be a good player under Rodney, and he took me to a good level. I had some injuries, a little bit of inconsistency as well, still there. But then when Paul got there, I'd matured a lot more. And obviously going with that grand final, the win there really sort of confirmed everything, that all the blood, sweat and tears and the hard work was worth it. And footy's given me a great life. It's given me a bloody good life. I've been able to look after my family and community because it's, I can afford to be able to do that. And, growing up, we had no such luxuries, I guess. And it's something I'm really proud of. And I like to think I'm a good bloke, and that was allowed me to help people who were less fortunate than myself, and maybe have missed that opportunity. But when I was a kid, when I saw opportunity, I absolutely jumped at them, and it didn't matter if I was the only black fella in the team. I'd still play cricket because I wanted to be the best cricket player. And the same with basketball, same with soccer, and it was the same at school. A lot of the cousins were in and out of school, but I was consistently there in attendance. I wasn't the best student, but I was consistently there. I guess that drive in it, I always thought there might be something better out there for me, and there was, and footy's been able to provide that for me.
The Go Foundation has been around for a number of years. What's changed, if anything, and are you seeing results?
Yeah, I mean, Goodsy and I have done footy clinics and community visits and, our whole footy careers, and the foundation is something that's just gone to the next level. We've been able to provide uniforms, playgrounds and fences for communities, because the people we know are really influential. And Goodsy and I, we knock on their door. I mean, we don't make any money out of it. We knock on their door and we say, look, we'll come and speak to your staff about leadership and culture, but how's about putting a playground up for the kids, because there's nothing to do in this community. And you know what? We've had a really good response for it. And as I said before, we like to think we're good people, so we just do it. We don't ask for anything. Like I said, we see the influence we have over a young generation, and certainly with our own people, we can see the influence that we do have because we've been successful on the field, and it's about translating that onto helping fellas who are less fortunate, communities that are less fortunate than when we grew up. And we remember back how tough it was when you had to borrow your cousin's footy boots and wear their hand-me-down shorts to training, and that was too big. And we know all that stuff. So if we can help in any way. I mean, that's what we do. And, you know, we've got some good people on board now that are trying to take that to the next level. And with our time, it's really, it's a, you know, our time's really precious because we've got a thousand things. Adam's still playing. He's the captain of the footy club, and he's a big spokesman for AFL players and Indigenous players and Indigenous people. But when we say, hey, mate, we've got to go to a school and we've got to do this, he's in the car and he's there waiting for me. And, yeah, as I said, there's no ego. We don't make any money. We do it because we want to do it. And if we can continue to do that, we'll do that to our last breath.
Briefly touch on your affiliation with Get Reading.
Yeah, look, Get Reading, it was obviously writing the book. It was, a natural partnership to help inspire young fellas to pick up a book and learn to read. It really is. I mean, if you can't read and write in the world today, you're really in a battle, and it's a tough environment outside in the world. So for me to be a part of that and go around and talk to people about how important it is to pick the books up, let your imagination run wild a little bit and immerse yourself in these books, and the people at Get Reading have done a fantastic job. And again, it's Adam and I are really happy to lend our profile, our faces and our voices to worthwhile causes, and we ask nothing in return, really. And it's just something that we think that's a good message to send, and if we could help in any way and people will listen to us, well, we'll do it, absolutely. And, the people at Get Reading are just really good people, and that's why we help.
This is it. One final question. Russ, after a documentary on your family ties was aired, I watched an internet video you conducted with the network, and one of the questions afterwards was, who would you like from your past to sit down with? You stated it would be hard to measure up with their achievements. They were pioneers. Yeah. You're no slouch, Russ. Are you content with being referred to as one of the best, legend even?
Look, it's something that you don't set out to do when you first start your career, but, I mean, when you play, I mentioned our games, you know, 300 games at Sydney. Look, if you told me that at 17, I'd have told you to bugger off. Like, I just wouldn't have believed you. But the fact is I'm the first one to do it, Adam's the second, and we're two Indigenous brothers who, you know, this club's 130 years of age, our culture's thousands and thousands of years of age. To be able to do that, I mean, that's really inspiring. And I sat down with Goodsy and I just said, mate, I'm so proud of what you've been able to do. And he said the same thing, and, you know, we catch up every week, and, you know, we're the best of mates. And, like, it's crazy. It's bloody crazy what we've been able to do. And, but it's really more important about how we conduct and carry ourselves and the message that we send to our young mob who watch us and look at us, because I think I said it before, we're aware of our impact and our presence around other people, and to be able to lead the way, we need more, you know, I always say that we don't need more footy players, but it's great that we got a lot of the brothers playing with us. But certainly for our career, and Goodsy and I have an issue with not walking around the city not seeing enough black fellas in suits and ties, and we're trying to change that. So it's not about I've finished footy now it's about the next phase of my career and setting a good example with that. So you know, my mum's in education, and they're the people that Adam and I really look up to. You know, what we've done is just kick a footy around, but there are people out there saving lives and teaching our young mob how to stay alive and to learn and to read and write and make contributions to society and things like that. And our advocates and, you know, in the government have been brilliant. And you know, we look at our what we've done, which is all we've done is run around on a field for a while and kick a ball. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending how you look at it, people really rate AFL players. And, you know, we've made our contribution and we're wrapped with what we've been able to do. But for us, it's always been about kids staying in school, and, you know, they love us because we're footy players, but we say, hey, boys or girls, you need to stay in school, you need to behave, you need to do this, and when you get older, make your own impact in the world. And hopefully we've been able to do that, and we're still trying to do that. But yeah, it's nice to when people pat you on the back and say congratulations on a good career as well.
Michael O'Loughlin speaking in Darwin with Rico Adrian about his autobiography with Jim Mayne. Mickey O, Determination, Hard Work and A Little Bit of Magic is published by HarperCollins. This is Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on RN. The gentle domestic art of cross-stitching gets a radical makeover in the work of the Brisbane-based artist, Dale Harding. I guarantee you won't find his work in a country fete. Dale learnt the practical techniques of cross-stitching from his mum while growing up in the bush in central Queensland. The embroidered works are not the only work in his first solo and graduate exhibition, Colour by Number. Sculpture and installation also feature in the show. Dale Harding is about to graduate from the Queensland College of Art, where he's been taught by the artists Jennifer Hurd and Gordon Hookey in the Contemporary Australian Indigenous Art course. He's also spent time working as a studio assistant to leading practitioners like Richard Bell and Tony Albert. Tony is also the curator of the exhibition, and we'll hear from him in a moment. But first, I ask Dale Harding to walk me through the show.
Hi, I'm Dale Harding. I'm a local Brisbane-based artist with roots that run back to central Queensland, to Gungala and Bidra country and elders, and I'm based in Brisbane these days.
Colour by Number is the name of this solo exhibition at Metro Arts. Colour by Number.
Yeah, Colour by Number. It refers to the oral history that's been given to me by my grandmother, my mother's mother, and Nana's often sat and talked to me about the systems and the processes that were involved with the Department of Native Affairs in the old times in Queensland. And there was a system there that had her referred to by an alphanumeric identification number. And so Colour by Number refers to a work that I made in response to that system, yeah.
So she had a number, I guess, as many Aboriginal people who were under the Act had a number.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I've got documentation of Nana's use of that number, being given that number, and her mother as well, applying for clothing for the children and for access to work and things under her number as well. So, yeah.
And this work over here on the wall is actually the first thing you see as you walk into the space, and it's the title of the exhibition, Colour by Number, but it's actually also a work? Or was Tony just pulling my leg?
A little bit of both. No, it's definitely a work. It is the title to the show, but it refers to a breastplate that I made, which the breastplate has the letters W38, letters and numbers W38, beaten into it, and the lead breastplate symbolises the weight and the toxic nature of that alphanumeric system.
And that's the work we're standing in front of now, that's a lead, that's a piece of lead fashioned into like a gorget or a breastplate?
Yeah, that's it. It was a risky process of making it, but the connotations of the lead are really important to how I needed to express this history, you know. It's toxic, it's heavy, it's cold, it doesn't have any precious metal values to it. It's quite an industrial, sort of mechanised metal, yeah.
And W38 is the number that your grandmother, that was her number.
Yes, that's how she was identified in the Warraminda mission and in the schooling system and in her being sent out into employment as a young girl, yeah.
All right, well, we'll move around. That work's already sold.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's been bought for a public collection.
Yeah.
Now, what's the title of this work? This work has a whole wall.
It does, and it needs a whole wall. I consider this work a quiet monument, and the work is called Of One's Own Country, and that refers back to the domestic and Aboriginal women and young girls being contracted out into domestic service. And there's an extensive history in my family, as in a lot of Aboriginal families, of women as domestic servants. My mother and my grandmother and my great-grandmother were all domestics in the one household for one doctor. That was actually a positive situation. That woman was very, very kind. But this, I consider, a quiet monument to the trials and difficulties faced by these young women and children sent out to, and older women as well, to domestic service.
And what's the... There's a round object which has a piece of thread around it. There's a round object. It looks like a matted hair, or I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, well, that's I'm glad you take that reading because that was intended. It's a ball of fine steel wool that you'd usually find for scrubbing. It's old-fashioned steel wool before it became stainless steel wool. And so I have patinaed and aged this steel wool to give the reading of a clump of hair, and in particular, pubic hair. And so it refers back to oral history given to me. I'm not necessarily inclined to share that oral history in the public arena, but there's history of sexual advances on young children, young women, and the punishment that comes from defending yourself against the advances of these people that were their employers, contracted employers, you know.
And there was this enormous internal traffic of Aboriginal domestics in service across the country, really.
Yeah, a huge demand, and governments were complicit in supplying that demand, you know, feeding that demand and continuing this cycle. So I consider this work a quiet but, you know, sort of potent monument to those women, yeah, and those histories. There's a single needle, a single embroidery needle with a metallic thread that hangs delicately. It's playing on the balance and the tension and the hanging by a thread connotations there.
This exhibition has been mapped in a certain... We're meant to see the work in a certain...
Yeah.
In a certain order.
Yeah.
So tell us about... What's the title of this work, first of all? Because that also appears to be quite important.
Yeah. Yeah, so this work is Breaking Boundaries. It consists of five hardwood surveyor's pegs, which have been treated in a way so as to reduce them. And it refers back to, on my father's side, there's an agricultural history, and my parents are still graziers at the moment. And surveyor's pegs, for us as kids, were very significant markers of where one property finished and the next began. And we had a respect drummed into us about these markers, but in reality, they're just a piece of timber, and it's an imposed system of ownership and division of land. So I've negated these surveyor's pegs by burning them down and reducing them down to embers and you know, remaining stubs.
They look like, you know, spent matchsticks, but they're wooden stakes, and they've burnt right down. Did you? I guess you physically must have burnt them. What did you do to accelerate that process? Because I imagine it could have been quite time consuming.
Yeah, well, that was some time spent up in the bush, actually. Really stoking that fire up. late at night. It was actually in winter as well that I was doing it. So, that was quite an interesting process of stoking it up and burning it down. And there was a real passion and intensity in that fire, and that was quite significant in itself. It was almost performative, you know.
And so I guess it relates to the way the land has been colonized, the way the land's been stolen.
I mean, there's many different possible readings, and all are valid, because I'm also operating here on the black and white. So the surveyor's pegs were generally painted white, and so now that they've been charred and burnt back, there's a blackening of them as well, and the whiteness has been charred and brought back to reality, I guess, too, that burnt timber underneath. So, and that's not necessarily an affronting reading that I'm intending. It's just a reminder that these are just pegs. Even though I had such an ingrained sense of reverence for this piece of timber that needed to be cared for and you know, not played around with, it's just a piece of timber that actually doesn't... You know, bushfire comes through, that piece of timber means nothing.
All right, we'll move to the next. And now there's a series of seven pieces on the wall. Yeah. What have you done with the Archer's paper?
These works are, again, devoid of colour. These works operate on notions of visibility and invisibility. So I've actually taken the Archer's paper and embroidered them in a clear yarn. And so the yarn's quite specific there. It's used for embellishments and for decoration in knitting and you know, scarf making, this sort of thing. But for this purpose, that clear yarn is devoid of colour, it's devoid of identity, and it's devoid of a title as well. So these paperworks are titled Untold Numbers, and they again refer back to that alphanumeric system and the breastplate and the title of the show, Colour by Numbers.
There's also, I guess, there could also be totems in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. They are native animal cross-stitch designs, which through processes of people giving me, particularly Tony, giving me these cross-stitch designs, I've repatriated them in a way, taken them from that hyper-kitsch and that sort of commercialised intended purpose and repatriated them in a way that speaks more to what these designs are rooted in, you know? So even in the books, when they're in their full colour, they still didn't speak of the totemic animals and the cultural systems and the people that these and the nation that the land that these animals come from.
So would you have got a pattern or a design from something like Family Circle? Or
yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that just to give people an idea of the kind of thing we're looking at here, because you know, even with a very bright light on, it's hard to see that yarn, which is almost invisible. Go and find the curator of this exhibition. Tony Albert. Now, you've curated this exhibition, this solo exhibition of Dale Harding's Colour by Number. How did you come to curate this exhibition?
Well, it's been a very interesting process. Dale was actually my assistant for a few years while I was here in Brisbane, and I think it's either a natural progression or something installed in me, I think, through, you know, my own family values and the work that I do with Proper Now, and that is this idea of passing on information and helping people out. And Dale was someone, you know, who I've just grown to love so much and seen his work progress, that when it came time to do a show, I really wanted to be involved somehow or give as much as I could, not only in making it the best, but Dale can learn from mistakes I've made as well and hopefully doesn't have to go through some of the same things.
Now, this work, you were saying it really, you knew you had to be involved when you saw this work, and this is the quiet monument that Dale described earlier to the domestic service of Aboriginal women, particularly women in his family.
Yeah, well, it's an incredibly emotional and emotive kind of work, and what I love about Dale's work is the conceptual elements of it that it brings to, I think, a new level that I haven't seen within contemporary art being made by Aboriginal people. I mean, I think it resonates elements of installation artists such as Julie Goff and Fiona Foley to an extent too, but there's something, a minimalistic quality to Dale's work which not only works beautifully as an object itself, but the conceptual development and what's going on behind the work is incredible. So here you have the wire stainless steel scouring pad that would have been used to cleaning that has been manipulated in such a way that it almost looks like a ball of pubic hair, or which sits alongside the statement by Rosalind Kidd and the needle and thread. I just think it's really stunning.
And we'll go next door, because this is the work that I said to Dale that reminds me most of you, and I guess that's fairly obvious because of the humour. I'm talking about these works, but also this work, oddly enough, reminds me too of you. Do you see yourself at all reflected in these works?
Maybe a little bit. What was great about using this space especially is there is that segmentedness. So whilst I think there's two very definite themes going on here, one, the family history and the kind of devastating nature of what happened within domestic life and as servants, and then the way in which Dale uses and references that through exploring ideas of gender and sexuality and having a more humorous, rather poetic side to his work. So I definitely think there's some kind of link between, you know, what we're all kind of doing here in Brisbane, and that's, you know, as Dale being an assistant to not only myself, he's worked with Richard Bell, lectured by Jennifer Hurd and Gordon Hookey. I can't help but think there's a bit, but as I said before, I really think Dale brings so much elements of himself through this, and I think it's something really new and really fresh that he's doing.
one of the works has gone to a public collection already. There's a lot of interest in his work.
An incredible interest. And that was another thing I, you know, felt that, you know, we can help our younger artists by, you know, even just attaching our names to it. I'm certainly not claiming to be a curator, but, you know, I knew the benefits that could come from being involved. And I always think, you know, when a talent comes along like Dal, you never lose, because I really have a feeling one day I could quite possibly be his assistant with the way he's going. But, you know, for Dale to get that broad span, and he's worked with other amazing artists like Madonna Staunton, you know, a very senior female, dare I say feminist artist, Gemma Smith, Emery Douglas, the former Minister for Culture with the Black Panther Party. I mean, the experience he's had already as such a young artist is amazing, and you see that through the quality of his work, not only in its conceptual development, but the outlay of it. He thinks about it all, and that's testament to, you know, someone. This is his third year graduating show. It's incredibly impressive.
Have you always been interested in embroidery, or?
Yeah, well, my mum is incredibly talented with anything creative, but particularly needlework, in terms of stump work and silk ribbon embroidery and all these highly, highly skilled European embroidery traditions that that a very skilled and highly articulate Aboriginal woman has taken and made her own. And she owns these skills and these styles now. So as little kids, we were taught cross-stitch, and we have pieces of hessian that I have still from when I was 7 years old, little samplers and things like that. So I've taken it on board.
Even I have been told that. And over here, can we have a look at this? This is a series of text works.
And, you know, they're quite sloganistic. Still operating within the domestic. These are embroidered text and pictorial designs, which were intended to bring some positivity and some humour and some lightheartedness to some, you know, sometimes sensitive topics.
Dale Harding. His solo exhibition, Colour by Number, is on currently upstairs at Metro Arts in Brisbane, where it runs through to the 6th of October. That's next Saturday. You also heard from Tony Albert, the artist and curator of the exhibition. You can see some of Dale's work on our website, abc.net.au/radionational. Just find Away in the program menu on the right-hand side of the page. This is Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on RN. The Interrogation of Ashala Wolf is the first instalment in a series of novels for young adults by the children's author and illustrator Abilene Quaymullina. The novel is set in a dystopian post-apocalyptic future, and it's the first in a four-part series. Abilene is the daughter of Sally Morgan, the author of My Place. And Abilene spoke with Rico Adrin earlier this year.
Hello, my name's Abilene Quaymullina. I come from the Balgu people of the Pilbara region of Western Australia, and I'm the author of a book called The Interrogation of Ashala Wolf, the first book in a four-book series called The Tribe. In this first passage, this is from the very first chapter of Ashala. So at this point, she is trapped in a detention centre, she's been captured by the government, and she's on her way to interrogation. She is accompanied by her guard, Justin Connor, and Justin Connor is the guy who betrayed her to the government, although you realise pretty much from the first chapter that perhaps all is not quite what it seems in this book. So she's walking with him down a hallway, and she's challenging him about, you know, why he felt the need to betray her, why it was such a big deal for the government to capture her. And it picks up, I'll start reading it from when he speaks. Connor spoke again. You are not one illegal. What? You are the tribe, Ashala. I frowned, and he continued. You were the leader, the glue that held them together. Now you're gone. It won't be long before they start squabbling with each other and leave the safety of the Firstwood. We think it won't be 6 months until they're detained. The enforcers here are taking bets on it. I inhaled sharply, furious, and not only because of what he'd said. The consuming rage I'd felt at discovering his betrayal rose up, and I wanted to make him feel some of the pain he'd caused me. If I had a sword, or a knife, or a big heavy bit of wood. But I didn't. All I had to strike him with were words. The tribe is bigger than me. They'll go on and grow stronger with every illegal that joins them until the day they march on your centres, Enforcer. Is that supposed to be a threat, Ashayla? I bared my teeth at him. There will come a day when 1,000 illegals descend on your detention centres. Boomers will breach the walls. Sky changers will send lightning to strike you all down from above, and rumblers will open the earth to swallow you up from below. There will be nowhere to hide, nowhere to run, and no way to stop them from freeing every single illegal in this centre. And when that day comes, Justin Connor, think of me.
Amberlynn, firstly, I'm going to say a bunch of words, and with each that I mention, please elaborate. Rumblers.
Ooh, that's one of the special abilities in my book. So basically, rumblers can cause earthquakes.
Menders.
Healers. So they can heal, and if they're powerful healers, they can heal pretty much any injury.
Boomers.
They can make things explode, so literally go boom.
Sky changers.
They can alter the weather.
Sleepwalkers.
Oh, that's a very special power. That's the power that belongs to the main character in the book, and she may just be the only sleepwalker in the world, but her power is she can interact with the world in an unconscious state while she's dreaming, and she can make what she sees in her dreams happen. So she can literally make dreams come true.
Fire starters.
Can control fire.
Amberlynn, can you tell us about the very first chapter that you submitted to Walker Books and why such a stir was created with the publisher?
Well, the first chapter is pretty close to what it is in the finished book, actually, because I worked on it for a long time before I submitted it. And I think what Walker loved about it was that it has a very strong main character with a really clear voice, and it's written a little bit in the style of a mystery novel, so I think they liked that too.
Amberlynn, can you paint us a picture of Firstwood, as you would, say, the Pilbara region, for instance?
Well, the Firstwood is the forest where my main character, Ashayla, lives, and it's a Tuart forest. And I based it on the Tuart forests that grow near where I live in the southwest of Western Australia. So Ashayla refers quite a lot through the book to the towering Tuarts. Now, the book is set 300 years after the world has ended, so it's not exactly the same as the Tuart forest we have now. The trees are very, very big, literally towering. And underneath them grow an understory of other trees, mostly peppermint trees and a range of other shrubs and plants. And it's a pretty good forest to live in because it has a lot of fresh water. It has quite an abundance of food. So Ashayla and the rest of her tribe, who have all run away from the government, are able to survive there.
Having done that, can you now give us a spiel on the balance?
The idea of the balance in the book is that because the way that the people in the book called the old world ended was in an environmental cataclysm. So the people who survived the cataclysm became obsessed with ensuring it never happened again. And they believe in something called the balance. And the balance is the harmony between all life, in essence. So they work very, very hard to make sure that balance isn't disturbed and the harmony between all life is maintained. And to that end, they really try to look after each other and look after the earth. Unfortunately, they view people who have abilities as being a threat to the balance. And for that reason, anyone with an ability is strictly controlled and locked up in detention centres by the government.
Amberlynn, tell us about your decision to write from Ashayla's perspective.
Well, I don't know if it was even a decision. It was more like I started to hear Ashayla's voice. And from the very beginning, her voice was just so clear and so strong and so powerful that I had to tell her story, and worked very hard at telling her story. And because it's told from her perspective, it was, I guess I felt more like I was discovering the story than telling it, discovering it with her and working with her to tell it.
Amberlynn, tell us, give us a time frame as to when the first idea for Ashayla's, the interrogation of Ashayla Wolf came along, and to this point now, how long has it taken the process?
Look, it's really difficult to estimate because I kind of worked on it in pieces. Probably the main bulk of the writing took about a year, but it was 2 years before that thinking about it. And it was probably even earlier than that that the idea first came along, because, in fact, it was my brother Blaise who came up with the title The Interrogation of a Shayla Wolf. He's very good at coming up with titles and names. So whenever I write something, I usually ask him for titles and names. So he came up with this title, and I thought it was a terrific title. And for a while there, the title just sat around doing nothing until I started to hear Shayla's story and began to tell it.
In an interview that I listened to recently, you mentioned that writing wasn't easy. Please explain.
Writing is incredibly hard work. If anyone's looking for something easy to do, pick something else. Because, and particularly writing a novel, because you're writing quite a lot of words together. You've got to write, you've got to edit. And I think the worst times are when you've written something, and when you write it, you're convinced that you've written something fantastic. You're like, oh, I'm the best writer on earth. And then you come back to it the next day, and you're like, this is terrible. This writing is complete rubbish. I'm the worst writer on earth. And you have to scrap the whole thing and start again. And so to write a novel, you've got to be prepared to just continually pick yourself up and try again till you get it right.
You've expressed an affinity with or toward dystopian fiction. Why is writing in this particular vein appealing to you?
I think what I love about dystopian fiction is that it asks bigger questions about the world. So I think pretty much all dystopian fiction is firstly pretty interesting stories. You know, they're happening after the end of the world. They're in societies that are far from perfect, and we're seeing people struggle against that. But I also think they ask larger questions about the nature of humanity and society and the place of people in the world. And I think that makes for very, very good stories.
Amblin, being of Indigenous heritage, tell us the importance of giving rise to an Aboriginal character in this genre, and such a strong character at that.
Yeah, well, I think Aboriginal people are pretty strong, so I guess that reflects that. And I think it's also important for Aboriginal people to be able to read books that have Aboriginal people in them. And we've increasingly seen that, I guess, over the last 30 years. There's a lot more books written by Aboriginal people than there used to be, and that is fantastic. And I'm really proud to be a part of that and a part of all the great Aboriginal writers in Australia.
To get to this point, you've mentioned that you've attempted novels prior. What was it about them that didn't work? Did you even submit them to publishers, the previous
ones? I never finished them. I have a whole box of unfinished novels. There's a lot. I've been trying to write a novel pretty much as long as I can remember, I think. And, yeah, they just didn't work. They weren't really terrible, but they just weren't good enough. So Ashayla is the first one that is really good, that's really worked. And I think the difference is Ashayla herself. I think it's the strength of that character and that story.
Amblin, what's the response been so far since?
It hasn't been out very long, about 3 weeks, but, people seem to really like it. So it's really nice, and the response has been very positive, which is fantastic. And I really enjoy talking to people about the book and hearing the different things that people like and, you know, their expectations for book two, which I'm working on at the moment.
Could you touch on the firstwood.com, what it offers fans of the book and how the site will evolve over the duration of the series?
Yeah, well, this is the website for the book and for the series. So you can download some stuff like, you know, digital wallpaper. I've got digital wallpaper on my computer that's got the cover of Ashayla Wolf. You can read some stuff about me and about the book. As we go along, we're going to be adding things to it. So we're going to add a thing where you can figure out what your animal is, because Ashayla and all the rest of her tribe are all associated with particular animals that live in the first wood. We're also going to be adding a thing later on where you can figure out what your ability is, and you get regular updates on what's happening with the book and with the series.
What would you like young readers to take from The Interrogation of Ashayla Wolf?
Well, firstly, I would just hope that they would enjoy the story, because I think that's really the whole point, is to write an enjoyable story. Beyond that, I think I'd like them to identify, I guess, with Ashayla's strength and realise that they have that strength, and with the bonds she had with the rest of the tribe. So the importance of friendship and family and the places that surround us.
Now, finally, I have to ask, because you were born of great riding pedigree, what have you adopted from your mother's riding talents? Perhaps it's specific advice she shared, or perhaps a nuance you noticed whilst growing up?
Well, I think it was helpful that I always knew that riding wasn't easy, because I think if you haven't grown up around riding, you can sometimes think that it is quite easy, that you just sort of sit down and dash off a few lines and there you go, you've got a story. So I always knew it was more work than that. But beyond that, Mum has just been so incredibly supportive, and she actually is the person who convinced me to stick with writing when I wanted to give it up once. So I think it is true to say that without her, the book wouldn't exist at all. At this point in the story, Ashayla has arrived with her friend Georgie at a place called the Grasslands, which is a really huge plains of grass, and they're inhabited by enormous people-eating lizards called saws. So Ashayla is sitting on a hillside with Georgie looking over the grasslands, and they've just spotted a saw in the distance, and she knows that they've got to hide. I twisted around, slithering backwards. Georgie shifted as if she was about to follow. Then, suddenly, she stood up and ran down the wrong side of the hill. I leapt to my feet, slipped and skidded. By the time I'd clawed my way back, Georgie was out on the grasslands and the saw was moving in her direction at an unbelievable pace. I belted after her, shouting, "Georgie, you're going the wrong way!" But she started skipping towards the monster, and I put on a new burst of speed. I had to reach her before the saw did. Grabbing hold of her arm, I tried to drag her backwards. She planted her feet on the ground and grinned at me, looking like a naughty kid who was playing a trick on her mum. What does she think she's doing? Has she totally flipped out? The saw was getting so close now that I could hear the ripping of its claws as it tore through the grass. Georgie still wouldn't move. I flung myself in front of her as the saw charged towards us, waving my arms wildly. "You want to eat somebody? Eat me!" And if you want to find out what happens next, you'll just have to read the book.
Amberlyn Quay Mulliner there, reading an excerpt from her novel The Tribe, The Interrogation of Ashayla Wolf, the first in a four-part series. It's published by Walker Books. Away is produced by Rico Adrin and me, Daniel Browning. The executive producer is Lorena Allam. Thanks to technical producer Kerry Dell. Join me next Saturday at 6 p.m. and in Evening Arts on Tuesday night at 9. For more Indigenous art and culture here on RN. I look forward to your company. Until then, keep safe and bye for now.
Authentic world.
Bruce Springsteen, The Boss, and why we're living in a post-authentic world.
Today, authenticity is a house of mirrors. It's all just what you're bringing when the lights go down.
That's Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.